So last Shabbat I talked about imbalance and what it looks like for a believer, what the consequences are, in essence what the fallout is. I also indicated that I would be sharing with you in greater detail the five aspects required for a believer to live in that balance. Just to refresh your memory, the five elements or the five aspects are prayer, study, worship, rest, and fellowship. I will be doing this. However, for starters, I believe in order to lay a strong foundation, we need to talk about the one who has provided this outline, the one whom we serve, honor, and worship, the one by whom all this is possible. What I'm about to share with you will sound rather simple, to the point of being basic. For those of you who ever went to college, this will be a level 101 class. Yet, when we become believers and grow in our faith, we tend to grow and either overcomplicate or oversimplify. Words you will likely be familiar with. Overcomplicated would be the equivalent of legalism. We impose more upon us than what Adonai, what his scripture even requires. Oversimplify, hypergrace. We impose less and therefore ignore what Adonai does require from us. Yet there is a balance that lies between these two extremes. If you've ever noticed a scale, the balance is in the middle. The scale rests upon a little pin or a little point that when you have nothing on the scales, they should be zero tear or balance. They should be equal. Yet it's when you place things on one side and then the other that you have to, how do I put this? You have to adjust your weights and measures on one side versus the other to maintain a balance. So what is faithfulness? Synonyms for faithfulness include fidelity, loyalty, devotion, dedication, dependability, one of being reliable or steadfast. The Hebrew word for faithfulness is emunah, E-M-U-N-A-H. Faith is emu. So emunah is, in essence, an expansion of the word faith. And there's really nothing spectacular in that it aligns with the English definition. So, sorry, I don't have a reveal that it's like, oh, well, it goes this. No, faith is faith in English and in Hebrew. Didn't look at the Greek, but I would say it's the same in the Greek as well. So Adonai's faithfulness can be broken down into the following. And there's 3 points, and each point I'm going to elaborate on, and by the end you'll have the 3 points. And then, the math geek that I am, I have an equation for you. And it's simple to remember. Point one, in order to be faithful, one must first make a promise to be faithful to. How can you be faithful to something if you have nothing to be faithful to? Let's start at Genesis 12, 1 through 3. This is what I call the point of origin for God's faithfulness to Abraham and the Jewish people. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. Now Adonai said to Abram, get yourself out of your country, away from your kinsmen and away from your father's house, and go to a land that I will show you. And notice how verse 2 starts. I will. What is God doing here? He's making a promise. I will make you a great nation. He's one individual. Yet he's going to make a great nation out of him. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you are to be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, but I will curse anyone who curses you. And by you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. This sermon, I didn't go into detail extracting each of those points. I may do that when it comes to this parsha. But keeping in mind, notice all the I wills that God made to Abram. And I mean, what does Scripture do but just lay everything out as evidence to the promise? This is where it all starts. Promises made to one individual whom will impact the rest of the world through his descendants. It is here that Adonai makes a promise, the first step to being faithful. It is here where we will begin to see the revealing of Adonai's faithfulness actually begin. As I've shared with you in past sermons, Adonai will further establish his promise to Abram in Genesis 15 and Genesis 17, establishing the promise of land and the reiteration of a generational promise. In other words, the promise doesn't stop with Abraham, but would continue from generation to generation and is still valid to this very day. After Israel's transgression of the golden calf, Adonai's anger raged against them to where Moses would intercede on behalf of the people and bring forth a reminder. Exodus chapter 32, verse 13. Remember Abraham, Yitzhak, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your very self. You promised them, I will make your descendants as many as the stars in the sky, and I will give all this land I have spoken about to your descendants, and they will possess it forever. Remember, there had to be a promise that was made in order to be faithful to. Moses is reminding God of that, given Israel's transgression in the desert. This would not be the first time Israel would try the impatience of Adonai. Jeremiah 31:32. It will not be like the covenant I made with your fathers on that day I took them by their hand and brought them out of the land of Egypt, because they for their part violated my covenant, even though I, for my part, was a husband to them. Now, keeping in mind, I would look at this as referring to God as a husband. He was a faithful husband, whereas Israel was unfaithful to him and ultimately to the promise. Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 58 and 59. You have brought it all on yourself with your depravities and disgusting practices, says Adonai. For here is what Adonai says, I will do to you as you have done. You treated the oath with contempt by breaking the covenant. He in essence says, I will repay your unfaithfulness. Because of your unfaithfulness. It is through this promise that Adonai has established a foundation by which he will operate by and be faithful to. In order to be faithful, you must have something to be faithful to. And this brings us to the next phase, or the next item. One must remember the promises that were made. Exodus chapter 3, verse 6 and 7. I am the God of your father, he continued, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Moses covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. Adonai said, I have seen how my people are being oppressed in Egypt and heard their cry for release from their slave masters because I know their pain. He heard. He remembered the covenant, the promise. And we're going to see in a couple minutes the next phase. But Ezekiel chapter 16, which we read verses 58 and 59, verses 60 through 63. Nevertheless, I will remember the covenant I made with you when you were a girl and will establish an everlasting covenant with you. Then you will remember your behavior and be ashamed of it as you receive your older and younger sisters and make them your daughters, even though the covenant with you does not cover that. And I will reestablish my covenant with you. Then you will know that I am Adonai, so that you will remember and be so ashamed that you will never open your mouth again. So ashamed will you be when I have forgiven you all that you have done, says Adonai. There's this idea of remembering associated to a promise. So, what's the third part? What's the third aspect? You, in essence, have to enter into something. Then you have to remember it. And then you must act upon what you remember. Going back to Exodus chapter 3, where God heard their cries. Verse 8, I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the country to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the place of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. This goes all the way back to the initial promise of bringing them into a land. God heard, God remembered, God acted. So how many of you have heard this verse before? And I'll read the King James first, just because it's probably more familiar to you. Behold, his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. What verse did I just read? Behold, his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Habakkuk 2:4. The just shall live by faith. Quit looking at my notes, by the way. The just shall live by faith. This is the complete Jewish Bible version. Look at the proud. He is inwardly not upright, but the righteous will attain life through trusting faithfulness. Remember I said that faith and faithfulness is in essence the same word, but one is just expanded a little more in Hebrew. So how do the just live by faith? Let's expand on this a little more. This verse, often quoted, is used to justify, this is all we have to do. All we have to do is live by faith. Yet living by faith is not passive. In order to have faith, you must first identify that the what or the who is. What do I trust in? Who do I trust in? You can't have faith without knowing. If you have faith without knowing, that's called blind faith. God does not tell us to live by blind faith. To say you have faith in God yet know nothing about him is merely a faith where you, in essence, say God exists. Yet this standard is not sufficient for the faith that is required to be in a relationship with him. So how is faith developed? Romans chapter 10. The problem is that they haven't all paid attention to the good news and obeyed it. For Yeshayahu, Isaiah says, Adonai, who has trusted what he has heard from us? So trust comes from what is heard. And what is heard comes through a word proclaimed about the Messiah. Anybody have any idea what verses I just read? Romans 10:17. Start in the back, Rob. Romans 10:16 and 17. It was Jane who said it. So faith is built on hearing. What are we hearing? The truth about Messiah, whom we are to trust in. Therefore, it is by what we have heard about him, his actions, his obedience to Adonai's word, his fulfillment to the promises made by Adonai, his faithfulness to his people, that establishes our faith for which we are to live by. Did everybody get all of that? Let me start over. What are we hearing in order for our faith to grow? The truth about Messiah, whom we are to trust in. Therefore, it is by what we have heard about him, his actions, what he did, his obedience to Adonai's word, his fulfillment to the promises made by Adonai, his faithfulness to his people. These are the aspects that establish our faith. Faith comes with hearing. Hearing leads to understanding. In essence, the three things that we're talking about. In order to be faithful to something, you have to make a promise to be faithful to, or to a person, so to speak. From there, you have to remember the promises that you made. And then you have to live or act by them. Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 5. Let your attitude toward one another be governed by your being in union with the Messiah. Though he was in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God something to be possessed by force. On the contrary, he emptied himself in that he took the form of a slave by becoming like human beings are. And when he appeared as a human being, he humbled himself still more by becoming obedient even to death. Death on a stake is a criminal. Therefore, God raised him to the highest place and gave him the name above every name. That in honor of the name given Yeshua, every knee will bow in heaven, on earth, and under the earth. And every tongue will acknowledge that Yeshua the Messiah is Adonai, to the glory of God the Father. So this is an aspect of putting your faith into practice. What good is it, my brothers, if someone claims to have faith but has no actions to prove it? Is such faith able to save him? What verse do you think I just read? Or in James, yes, you sort of saw the writing on the wall. About doing, it's like, oh, we're on a path to James. Yes, we're on a path to James. That was a question posed by Yaakov in verse 14. What good is it if someone claims to have faith but has no action to prove it? Going on, suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food, and someone says to him, Shalom. Keep warm and eat hearty without giving him what he needs. What good does it do? It's like saying to someone who has an empty plate, Bon appetit. the words are meaningless. Thus, faith by itself, unaccompanied by actions, is dead. But someone will say that you have faith and I have actions. Show me this faith of yours without the actions, and I will show you my faith by my actions. Here you have on a scale, faith without actions, faith with action. And in essence, when God measures it, one is weightier than the other. Faith with action is weightier than faith without action. Because if you think about it, action has substance, inaction has nothing. So by definition, it should be heavier. Verse 19, you believe that God is one. Good for you. The demons believe it too. To believe that God is just God and he exists, that's fine. But keeping in mind, you just got thrown, in the fire bath with the demons because they even acknowledge that God exists as well. The thought makes them shudder with fear. But foolish fellow, do you want to be shown that such faith apart from action is barren? Wasn't Abraham of Enoah, Abraham our father, declared righteous because of actions when he offered his son Yitzhak on the altar? You see that his faith worked with his action. By the actions, the faith was made complete. And the passage of the Tanakh was fulfilled, which says, Abraham had faith in God, and it was credited to his account as righteousness. He was even called God's friend. Yaakov continues, you see that a person is declared righteous because of actions, and not because of faith alone. Likewise, wasn't Rahab, the prostitute, also declared righteous because of actions when she welcomed the messengers and sent them out by another route? Indeed, just as the body without a spirit is dead, so too faith without actions is dead. So think of it this way. Think of the actions of your faith as the Spirit of God. And is the Spirit of God truly living in you? Or is what's living inside you actually dead because the Spirit is not active? Does Adonai practice what he preaches? Absolutely. So what I have shared with you can be remembered by this simple equation. All you people who hate math, it's like, oh no, he's doing this again. It's, trust me, it's simple. Faithfulness equals promise plus remembrance plus action. That's how simple it is. There's no square root. There's no complex mathematical equation. Faithfulness equals promise plus remembrance plus action. Make a promise in order to remember it and then act upon it. And you want to know what you can do with this equation? You can apply it to just about anything. Marriage. Marriage is a promise. Where remembrance is required and action is a must. Friendship. Business relations. Congregational relations. This equation can be applied to all of these things. There may be something that I may not have mentioned, but fill in the blank. Wherever there's a promise made, you have to remember it and you have to act upon it. If you are truly faithful to something or someone, then you have the basis, the foundation for how to accomplish this ever so precious product. What is that byproduct? What is the product of faithfulness? Trust. For which faith is required. I've provided you examples of Adonai's faithfulness to his people, by whom he made the covenant with. Now let me provide you with an example of that faithfulness that for many of you has occurred in your own lifetime. Well, God's been faithful in the past. Oh, well, I mean, yeah, but is he been faithful today? I mean, we talk about him being faithful within our lives. But I'm talking about going back in Scripture, and is he still faithful to the promises he made millennium ago? Generations and generations and generations.
The Muslim nations in the Middle East would not accept Israel's existence since its founding in 1948. They began amassing huge amounts of sophisticated weaponry and lobbying for the implementation of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against the Jewish state. On the 15th of May 1967, on Israel's Independence Day, a three-week period began, which was one of the most tense and fearful periods in Israel's history. In direct contravention of international agreements, Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser removed the UN peacekeeping forces and began moving tens of thousands of soldiers and hundreds of tanks into what was the demilitarized Sinai Peninsula towards Israel's southern border. Egypt also blockaded the Straits of Tehran, an open international waterway which was essentially a declaration of war. Israel turned to the nations of the world, primarily to the United States, for assistance against Egyptian aggression, but somehow all Western countries decided to remain neutral. Very quickly it became apparent that the promises were all but forgotten. Israel, with 2.5 million Jews, was left alone to face the might of the Arab nations. Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon formed a military alliance and began moving forces into Jordan towards Israel's borders. When the Arab countries realized that the world had abandoned Israel, many other Muslim countries were openly calling for the destruction of Israel. The will and means to murder millions of Jews were evident. Top IDF commanders expressed their concerns at the high price Israel was liable to pay in a war with the Arab world. Some military experts projected a toll between 20 and 100,000 lives. Israel prepared cemeteries all over the country, ready to accommodate many expected victims. Massive parks were prepared in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and other cities in case the cemeteries would have no more space. World governments, instead of defending Israel's right to exist, warned Israel continuously not to attack. However, the people of Israel had no choice but to go to war to defend their country and their very existence. At 7:15 a.m. on June 5th, 1967, the IDF launched Operation Moked Focus. Almost the entire Israeli Air Force was dispatched in a daring mission. Only 12 planes stayed behind. The risk of this operation was extraordinary, as the fighter pilots flew at an unprecedented low altitude of less than 20 meters above the ground. Egypt had the most advanced ground-air missile defense systems in the Middle East. Most of the Israeli jets were old and outdated French planes. If the Israeli jets would have been detected, many would have fallen, and Israel would have been left with practically no air force. And then, a miracle occurred. The most advanced Russian MiG jets that patrolled the airspace along the borders between Egypt and Israel were, for that one critical hour, grounded. Incredibly, at that very same time, the top commanders of Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq flew together to observe the Egyptian forces invading Sinai. The Egyptian officers had ordered all anti-aircraft units not to fire unless given a direct order as long as they were in flight. This created total confusion on the Egyptian ground as Israel struck exactly in that window of time. By 7:45 a.m., the high hand of providence resulted in the Israeli Air Force reaching all the Egyptian airfields without even one plane being detected. More than 200 Egyptian planes, almost half of Egypt's fleets, were almost instantaneously destroyed, also bombing the runways and making impotent the mightiest air force in the Middle East. General Moti Hod, commander of the Air Force, said, "In my wildest dreams, I never would have conceived of such an incredible success." A second wave of Israeli jets were directed to Cairo to confront the remains of the Egyptian Air Force. And here, another miracle occurred, no less miraculous than the first. Even though Israel had lost the element of surprise and the anti-aircraft systems were operating with full capacity, Egypt was only able to hit one Israeli plane. The Israeli Air Force went on to destroy a total of more than 300 Egyptian planes, and every airfield in Egypt was neutralized. It was nothing less than a military miracle, seemingly impossible. And then, another miracle occurred. It was as if God hardened the heart of the Egyptian president Nasser, who continuously gloated about his glorious military victory over Israel. In the Arab media, President Nasser spoke of the end of Israel's air force and of the Egyptian tanks on their way to Jerusalem. Jordan, Syria, and Iraq believed these bombastic statements and wanted to join him in the great victory against the Jews. All the Arab air power struck simultaneously on multiple fronts. In almost any other scenario, Israel would not have been able to respond as quickly as it did. The timing was seemingly orchestrated to position Israeli jets exactly where they should be. Not in 6 days, but in 6 hours, the war was won.
A biblical prophecy comes to pass as the forces of Israel sweep on in an astonishing triumph of strategy.
After achieving air supremacy, her forces thrust like an avenging sword at the very heart of Arab self-confidence.
And then, perhaps, the greatest miracle of all, a miracle Israel never expected, Jerusalem. Again, it seemed as though it was a divine appointment in time. Jerusalem was to be restored to the Jewish people after 2,000 years. The enemies of Israel had twice as many soldiers as we did, 3 times as many planes, 4 times as many tanks. The odds were stacked against us on every military front. The love of Israel, self-sacrifice, and courage of the Israeli soldiers, combined with divine guidance and assistance, made these miracles possible. Yitzhak Rabin, then the Minister of Defense, was given the honor of giving the war its name. He chose the Six-Day War, recalling the 6 days of creation, as Israel too was created with the liberation of Jerusalem. As the center of gravity of the Jewish people has now returned to the land of our fathers, the Torah center of the world has once again returned to Jerusalem. The chief rabbinate of the state of Israel has established the 28th of Iyar, a day of Hallel and Hodayah, praise and thanks for the salvation of our people and the liberation and return of our capital, Jerusalem. Jews in Israel and in every country in which they reside come together in prayer and celebration. Similar to Hanukkah and Purim, it sometimes takes many years for the miracles to be fully recognized and celebrated. The Mizrahi World Movement is involved in massive community-wide celebrations across the globe, from London to Los Angeles, from Melbourne to Johannesburg to Chicago and Toronto. For 2,000 years, our hope never died. Our faith as a people never wavered. Wherever Jews were and whenever they prayed facing Jerusalem. Whatever happened the night before, whether it was the Crusades, the Inquisition, Muslim oppression, or Nazis in Germany, the next morning a Jew would wake up, dust himself off, put on his tallit, face Jerusalem, and pray to come home, knowing somehow, some way, God would bring us back. This is our greatest celebration. to be alive in this generation where the prayers of our fathers and mothers have finally been answered, to be alive and to take part in Jewish destiny, to experience miracles of divine providence, bayamim hahem, bazman hazeh, like in those days, but in our time.
Brace yourself, because you're going to see that again in June, because one of the things is that through Scripture you can see the fingerprints of God all over that week. And we're going to put the fingerprints together so that you actually have a background or an understanding of how God operated at that time and how God operated previously. To say, oh, well, it was a coincidence. Oh, well, yeah, okay, it was a miracle. But it's not just a miracle. It's God's, how to put this, it's God remembering his promise and acting. This was God acting, even though you don't see the heavens parted and God revealing himself, but you see God acting nonetheless. And for those of you who weren't able to see it very well, and maybe the sound was a little muddy, there's a link in my notes that you can actually watch it on your computer directly. So this promise that leads to a remembrance that requires action. We see this in Deuteronomy 30. When the time arrives that all these things have come upon you, both the blessings and the curse, which I have presented to you, and you are there among the nations to which Adonai your God has driven you, then at last you will start thinking about what has happened to you. God remembers, but we are also required to remember what got us to the point of being exiled. What separated us from God was not God himself, but us. And you will return to Adonai your God and pay attention to what he has said. Pay attention to what he said. I think you're going to remember what he said. Pay attention to what he said, which will be exactly what I am ordering you to do today. You and your children, with all your heart and with all your being. At that point, Adonai your God will reverse your exile. Action. He will reverse the exile and show you mercy. Action. He will show his mercy. How? He will return and gather you from all the peoples to which Adonai your God has scattered you. If one of yours was scattered to the far end of the sky, Adonai your God will gather you even from there. Does this remind us of the shepherd going after the one while the 99 are safe? Adonai your God will bring you back into the land your ancestors possessed, and you will possess it. He will make you prosperous there, and you will become even more numerous than your ancestors. There's another promise. Then Adonai your God will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your children, and that you will love Adonai your God with all your heart and all your being, and thus you will live. This is occurring as we speak, as we breathe, as each moment winds down. This is continually happening. Just start in chapter 30 and read on. Then, let me close with this psalm. Psalm 89. And let me read you the first verse. I will sing about Adonai's act of grace forever. With my mouth proclaim your faithfulness to all generations. So the writer here is Etienne the Ezrahi. And he goes on to write, inspired by God, because I said grace is built to last forever. In the heavens themselves, you established your faithfulness. He made a promise with man on earth, but it was established from his throne above. You said, I made a covenant with the one I chose. I swore to my servant David, I will establish your dynasty forever, build up your throne through all generations. Let the heavens praise your wonders, Adonai, your faithfulness in the assembly of the angels. For who in the skies can be compared with Adonai? Which of these gods, small g, can rival Adonai, a God dreaded in the great assembly of the holy ones and feared by all around him? Adonai Elohei Tzavaot, who is mighty as you? Yah, your faithfulness surrounds you. You control the raging of the sea when the waves rear up. You calm them. You crush Rahab like a carcass with your strong arm and scattered your foes. The heavens are yours and the earth is yours. You founded the world and everything in it. You created north and south. Tavor and Hermon take joy in your name. Your arm is mighty, your hand is strong, your right hand is lifted high. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Grace and truth attend you. How happy are the people who know the joyful shout. They walk in the light of your presence, Adonai. They rejoice in your name all day and are lifted up by your righteousness. For you yourself are the strength in which they glory. Our power grows by pleasing you. For our shield comes from Adonai. Our king is from the Holy One of Israel. There was a time when you spoke in a vision. You declared to your loyal prophets, I have given help to a warrior. I have raised up someone chosen from the people. I have found David, my servant, and anointed him with my holy oil. My hand will always be with him, and my arm will give him strength. No enemy will outwit him, no wicked man overcome him. I will crush his foes before him and strike down those who hate him. My faithfulness and grace will be with him. Through my name, his power will grow. I will put his hand on the sea and his right hand on the rivers. He will call to me, you are my Father, my God, the rock of my salvation. I will give him the position of firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. I will keep my grace for him forever, and in my covenant be faithful with him. I will establish his dynasty forever and his throne as long as heavens last. If his descendants abandon my Torah and fail to live by my rulings, if they profane my regulations and don't obey my mitzvot, I will punish their disobedience with the rod and their guilt with lashes. But I won't withdraw my grace from him or be false to my faithfulness. I will not profane my covenant or change what my lips have spoken. I have sworn by my holiness once and for all, I will not lie to David. His dynasty will last forever, his throne like the sun before me. It will be established forever like the moon, which remains a faithful witness in the sky. I will. These are the promises that God made to David that is based on a promise of a covenant that God remains faithful to even to this day, even in spite of unfaithfulness. God continues to remain faithful. And it's because of this covenant with David, where God made a promise to David, God remembers the promise he makes to David, and the action is performed by Yeshua. The action of taking on the promise of the throne of David. For as a descendant of David, he will reside on his throne when he returns. So this is an example of Adonai's faithfulness to David and his impact upon all who were part of the covenant. Yet at this time, the time this psalm is written, there remained an unresolved separation. This does not negate the promise of Adonai, but is a result of the promise and the violation of the conditions of the promise. So God continues to remain faithful, even when we don't. So when we understand about his faithfulness, hopefully that's an encouragement for us to return to be faithful to him. Because at the end of this psalm, verses 51 and 52, your enemies, Adonai, have flung their taunts, flung them in the footsteps of your anointed one. And the writer closes off, blessed be Adonai forever. Regardless of what's going on around, regardless of the battles that are being waged, he remains faithful to those who remain called to him. Just like the example that I gave you on the Six-Day War, God remained faithful to a promise that goes back 3,500 plus years. Back all the way to Genesis 12. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you, and the families of the earth will be blessed because of you. So God's faithfulness knows no bound in time. But in essence, because he does not reside in time and is eternal, his promises reside outside of time. So again, the idea of God's faithfulness, very simple in nature. Yet there's a structure for it. He made a promise. He remembered his promise. And he acted upon the promise he made. This is the equation by which we can all live by. Like I said, it's not that complicated. There's complexity to it, but it's not that complicated. So if everybody will please rise.